So, Iran, the Cheney administration, if you will, was following its Iraq model of preparing the nation for another war until the quagmires in Iraq and Afghanistan and Wall Street made another war impossible even for them. And one of their primary tools was to act as if President Ahmadinejad was Iran. I recall asking an Iranian-born cab driver who was in regular contact with his family back home how the Iranian people feel about Ahmadinejad, and he said he was basically a joke. A blowhard who made all sorts of inflammatory statements that really didn't express the views of the people. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? But he also didn't express the feelings and the views of the nation's actual leaders, the mullahs who rule over the government. So we'll go into that when Jody Evans joins us in a moment. Jody Evans is the co-founder of the International Occupation Watch Center in Iraq, and of Code Pink, with, among others, Medea Benjamin. And Jody's Baghdad journals are at the center of the 2003 book Twilight of Empire. She's also co-editor with Medea Benjamin of Stop the Next War Now. And she and Medea and retired Colonel Ann Wright just returned from Iran a few days ago. And it's really nice of you to be with us, Jody. Jody, one thing, let me to set a little context here. Jody, as I recall, I had her on the show more than once when she had traveled to Iraq. She and a group traveled to Iraq before the war and then were some of the first non-sort of embedded folks to travel there again after the war. And so I think what she's about to tell us is how they had that same impulse to do that with Iran and thus bring citizens together under, you know, beneath the level of what usually happens with the diplomats and so on. So, Jody, you're back with us now. And the question was, I just told people about how you had traveled to Iraq several times. And so now, how did this trip to Iran take place?
So as I was saying, when I went 3 years ago, I met with too many people and asked too many questions, so our visas were getting denied for our citizen diplomacy trips out of Code Pink. So we complained and asked for a meeting with Ahmadinejad when he was in New York in September, and were granted that meeting along with about another 75 leaders of peace organizations throughout the United States. And we got to ask the question, you know, if you really, he said he was committed to peace, and we said, if you're really committed to peace, why are you denying our visas? You know, peace really happens from the bottom up, and citizen diplomacy has to start. And so, you know, to us, he said, okay, no problem. He looked at his ambassador and said, make sure they get an invitation and get to come. We said, we don't want to come as tourists, which is how he, you know, the only visas you can get. We want to come and meet with people in government, to which he agreed.
Okay, so that's interesting. Was it easy for you to get that meeting with Ahmadinejad?
Well, I guess we asked and we got it, which is interesting. We've, you know, we never gotten to meet with Bush, nor has Cindy Sheehan about her son, and nor have we ever gotten to meet with Nancy Pelosi since she became speaker. So it was interesting to ask and get permission to meet with a leader of another country. But, you know, yes, I will second what you said as you began the show, is that, you know, what a president is of Iran and what one is of the United States are quite different. That those who rule Iran are the religious mullah, and that, you know, he is a blowhard and nobody takes him seriously and they think he talks too much and he's kind of a dandy.
The thing about that, of course, is that to personify Iran as Ahmadinejad and to demonize Iran as Ahmadinejad serves the purposes of a bellicose administration and a lazy press.
Correct.
Because it gives them both a juicy story. And you really, I mean, of course, as I said, you just have to ask a cab driver or you have to dig a little bit. But so what you guys,
well,
when
did also really discourages the Iranians, you know, because that's not how they want to be seen. It's, you know, a highly intelligent community of very sincere hearts.
Yeah.
And so it disturbs them. But just, you know, like when we went to Iraq and when you go to any country where the image of it is manipulated, they know that we're not Bush and they love Americans, and, you know, and they want to be known as not Ahmadinejad or the way they're portrayed as they are so concerned in Hollywood. I mean, one of the things they asked is please go back and tell the people in America who we really are and how much we love them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a lot of what we did was asking Iranians to give a message to Obama, and so we did a lot of talking in the streets. And I was talking to one young woman. She said, you know, I feel like I live on an island. And I didn't realize how potent it is for the people who live in Iran and how closed that society is, and that they really are kind of kicked out, you know, abused and stepped on. And we met with the James Carville of Iran, the media advisor to Ahmadinejad. He wasn't supposed to win, but these three media advisors kind of packaged him in a way and sold him. And Medea was complaining about her job. You know, you have to be covered while you're there. And she was complaining, saying, you know, this, I feel really claustrophobic with this on, and why do you make me wear this? And,
oh, you don't mean covered by the press. You mean covered with the burqa.
Yeah, it's a hijab. They don't have burqas in India.
In Iran.
Those are Afghanistan. It's a different religion. Afghanistan is Sunni, and Iran is Shia. But you have your hair has to be covered. There's clothing laws that you have to follow. And he said, you know, we come to your country and we follow your rules. You come to our country and you follow our rules. But as we were leaving, the man who was with us, who doesn't speak English but was translated, he said, he kind of grabbed Medea's neck where she ties hers around her neck, and she looks like she's taking, he says, you know, you complain about the hijab. We've had that on us, you know, like with his, you know, like a hand at your neck for 30 years. And so, really, if you imagine it, here's a country that's basically been stepped on by the United States for more than 30 years. I mean, we overthrew their democratically elected amazing leader, you know, in 1953.
Right. And this is something, let's just take a moment. For those of you who the history and even the recent history of Iran is not an open book, it's that one is not even controversial. It's very clear that the U.S. Overthrew a elected and a pretty much loved and modernizing leader.
Correct.
Yeah. In 1953, and then put the Shah in power, and then...
And then we were trying to overthrow that government, and we even shredded the evidence as they were taking the hostages at the embassy in Tehran. And you know that Iranians took the sacks of shredded paper and pasted them back together. It took years to figure out. So they have the proof of why they revolted against the embassy was that they had been funded to overthrow yet again another government.
Let me back up just a little bit. And how many went with you? Who went with you?
Oh, it was just Medea, myself, and Anne Wright.
So that's Medea Benjamin, one of the other co-founders of Code Pink, and Anne Wright, who is a retired colonel.
She's a retired colonel, but she was also a member of the State Department and acting ambassador. She was the member of the State Department that opened up the Afghanistan mission. She's got a Medal of Honor, but she resigned her position a few days before Bush invaded Iraq, disgusted that she could no longer represent a country that could do such a thing.
So she's someone who worked on the military side and the diplomatic side.
30 years in the Army, and I think 15 in the State Department.
Right. I've had her on the show in the past. So how long were you there?
A week.
A week. And you returned when?
Thursday.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I just happened to run into Jody over the weekend and said, hey, can you get on Tuesday? What cities did you visit?
I had already been there, so I just went to go to Tehran and have actually, you know, meetings with people that you're usually not allowed to meet with. Matter of fact, we met with two members of parliament, two women members of parliament, and we asked them, you know, had they met with other Americans before, and one had been there for 8 years, and she had never met an American.
Wow. Wow. She'd been in Parliament for 8 years and never met an American.
They're not allowed. One of the things we're going to come back and do is figure out how they can meet women members of Congress who, when we were going, said, please, let's figure out how to make that happen. So there is a meeting of legislators happening in Canada, world legislators, and so we're trying to figure out how they can meet there, but they can't meet in Iran or the United States.
Is that the policy? Jody, one question. Is that the policy of both countries?
Yeah. This is the first time they'd really kind of offered a government visa instead of a tourist visa. So we got to have meetings that hadn't happened before. I mean, meetings with the State Department happen with advice, on that level. But this is, an NGO coming in and meeting with members of the government. It just doesn't happen.
Right. So an NGO person might get to go into Iran, but they'd go there as a tourist, and they wouldn't be able to really have the kind of meetings you had.
Matter of fact, I got in a lot of trouble for doing it before, for meeting people in the resistance party and speaking to people in the media. That's why our visas had gotten denied before.
Right. How free on this trip were you to go and see what and who you wished?
We were free to go anywhere, but we were kind of threatened. We wanted to go to a meeting of the Mothers for Peace, which is a radical, it's kind of the code pink of Iran. And we were warned that if we went, it might mean we wouldn't get any more visas. And so we were kind of on our best behavior because we want to continue. We really want to create a bridge that is sturdy. So we didn't go to that meeting. We didn't get to meet with any of the resistance party again because that, could have caused problems.
In other words, while you
that I'm sure the government doesn't know we met with. By, going out to dinner and them being there. Or there's a really famous young woman blogger who's widely read. And she's very courageous and even, consented to giving us her name. But, again, because you have to be careful because you don't want to get someone you meet with in trouble because you could leave and they can end up in jail.
Exactly.
We did meet. I have to, it was very humbling to meet with the women's peace movement there. By the way, it's huge. It's growing. The confidence of these women that they will be able to change their world is inspiring. They've been in jail for 8 years. They've been tortured. This young woman blogger had been in jail. They really are committed. And one thing they do know that if anything happens, if the U.S. were to come in and bomb or do anything, that it jeopardizes 30 years of work on their part. That the Iran-Iraq war, the revolution happened, and it was supposed to be different. But because we funded Iraq to immediately invade them, that war is what created the fundamentalist Islamic, kind of ruling structure that they have.
In other words, let me see if I've got this right. That what seems to happen so often, and I think it's one of the things we're afraid of now between India and Pakistan, is that if extremists benefit when there's threats to the country, that nationalism and extremism seems to, it worked in this country after 9/11, and you're saying that's one of the things that led the revolution to evolve in the form it did.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so they're very concerned, very, very concerned. Everyone's very concerned about, the rhetoric they hear about Iran from the United States. And first of all, it's very interesting to be in a country where everyone you meet knows that war is not the answer. Our new Code Pink's new campaign is called War is So Over. It's obsolete and should be, put in the dustbin of the 20th century. And to be in a country where there isn't anyone that believes that that is an answer or a solution, where the people we met with many men who had fought in the 8-year war, and what they've given their life to is creating books, movies, theater that continually show you the obsolescence and the stupidity of war. It was very inspiring. I saw 3 films about the 8-year war while I was there that were unflinching. and brilliant.
How many people, I mean, I don't know if you have that number, but how many Iranians died in that war?
They say 1 million, but I think they mean 1 million, like in casualties, like 1 million dead and wounded, so I don't know the actual death.
Yeah, yeah. And the population of Iran?
75 million.
Okay, so one out of 75 people in the country. This is the kind of things that happened in World War II.
Right.
And so, yeah, in other words, here's a country that, that when, you know, as terrible as the war following our invasion of Iraq has been, the way that we do it is only the military and their families really feel the pain. But this was one where both the country of Iraq and the country of Iran really felt the pain of that war.
Well, and again, it's not just the pain of the war, which was horrific, and those stories are horrendous, but it's also the pain of the war, which was, there was a revolution that promised, you know, to take everyone back to the 50s, you know, where they had this democratically elected leader, and instead what it brought in was a marriage of church and state, you know, that your worst nightmares couldn't have imagined. And for women, it's particularly bad because they, you know, they don't have equal rights, and they fight hard for them, and that's, you know, Shirin Ebadi is a Nobel, won a Nobel Peace Prize for that, and they can lose their children if they try to divorce, and there's, you know, multiple marriages and no inheritance and you know, real things, and they've been rising up, and it's real consequences. It's quite, you know, it's, for me, it's like we don't even say we go to jail to them because it's not even close to the same experience.
Right, right. So what you're saying, by the way, is that this if Americans think of Iran at this point, and I'm not saying all Americans, but the public view, let's say the media and administration view, it's going to be about their nuclear program. It's going to be about their relationship with Israel. It's going to be about their relationship with Iraq, and it's going to be about what a danger they are. What you're saying is all of that is in play in Iran. But the struggle just for rights, the struggle for women's rights, the struggle for freedom, is much more a present in everyone's everyday life.
Oh yeah, and don't forget that the story about Iran, I mean, just the things you mentioned, are, you know, have been blown out of proportion, misinterpreted, or blowhard, you know, messages.
Yeah.
They're not what Iranians feel. You know, that whole story also has just, it's exaggerated and misinterpreted.
Well, what I was talking there was that to Americans, it's all about Iran externally, you know, Iran in relationship to Iraq, Iran in relationship to nuclear power and so on. To people in the country, that some of that, you know, there's nuances to all that. But the actual, what they're trying to save their country from the path that it's been thrown into.
Correct.
Yeah. You visited Iraq several times, both before the invasion and afterwards. How do you compare your experiences?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that Iraq was a secular country, but it's a much more religious country, where Iran is a very, you know, it's not religious at all. Most people are secular. They think their religions, you know, they've seen the hypocrisy of it and the control of it, and it just, nobody, you know, people laugh at it. Not everyone. In Qom, you know, there are people that are very religious, including, that was an interesting part about the meeting with Ahmadinejad, that he's a true believer in the same sense as kind of Bush
or Palin or those
Palin,
folks.
Palin, you know, he's like lives in another world. It's just clearly, it's arrogant, and he has no clue what the real world looks like, and he tells you lots of stories, and the shadow behind him is a mile long. But, you know, there are, you know, one of the women that we met who's in parliament is a religious studies professor and, you know, fully covered and very seriously religious, and, you know, did the party line, and you couldn't really take her seriously. And the other one was a doctor, and really you could have a good conversation with, and represented a piece of Tehran, a poor section of Tehran, and works as a doctor while she also is a member of parliament.
You know, the thing that I've always wondered about, or at least wondered about for years, that I've heard this from my friends in L.A. who still have family in Iran or are in close contact with Iranians, that what maintains the religious fundamentalist hold on the country when it seems that so many people of the country would be going an entirely different way?
Well, the army is under the control. The army and the police are under the control of the religious conservatives, and it's quite violent. I mean, it's quite violent. People die. It's real, and that, you know, you're able to keep people in control for quite a while with that level of violence.
Mm-hmm. So it really is a very, very oppressive dictatorship.
Very, very oppressive.
And when the elections have happened, because they do have elections, mm-hmm. the supreme leaders disqualify most of their opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And then if even a few of the opposition run, and see if I'm correct on this, this is going back a little bit, but when Ahmadinejad did win his election,
mm-hmm.
There wasn't a feeling that it was stolen. There was a feeling that he did win. But wasn't it, it seemed to me that what happened there was the moderate candidate or one of the leading moderate candidates that was allowed to run, Rafsanjani, was considered corrupt by not just the mullahs, but by everyone, and that Ahmadinejad offered a populist message, which was an anti-corruption message and an economic change message, and that you know, the opposition they did allow to run had big baggage.
Well, yeah, but don't forget that, you know, Hatemi was he was elected, and he was a reformist candidate, and he was elected by women and the youth. I mean, the funny thing about going there and talking about Obama is they look at us, you know, they've kind of been through 8 years of Hatemi, and, you know, he was the change agent, and he wasn't able to do a thing. So for them, they say it's the structure. You know, you can elect the change agent, but inside the structure, he can't really do anything. And, you know, Hatemi is still very revered, even though he wasn't able to accomplish anything. And I think people, in a sense, forgave him because they could see that, you know, they had hoped there would be change, but that the structure was not going to let that happen. I mean, you know, another interesting thing is that this young blogger we met, her big cause celeb, what her activism is about, is getting women to be able to go into the soccer matches. And they've, you know, been arrested, and they've broken in, and they've, you know, and Ahmadinejad passed a law that women could go in the soccer matches, and the religious mullahs, you know, immediately the next day said, no, that's an invalid law, and null and voided it. So, you know, I think the elections are fair, you know, kind of after you pass the first hurdle of,
right,
you know, being, you know, saying that you will uphold the laws of the land.
Right.
Then, you know, I think they let the elections happen, because I had been there right before the elections 3.5 years ago, and Ahmadinejad was not supposed to win, and it was a strategy of these guys we met with that was a strategy to go into the, you know, it's kind of like to go into the rural areas,
mm-hmm.
where people are more conservative and run the campaign from there, and that was effective. And again, like you said, it was about the economy. Now, he's been devastating for the economy.
That's right.
He's made a lot of mistakes.
And although he hasn't been overturned, his party or his allies have been losing in local elections over the years, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And also the problem is when we talk to people, you know, about what's going to happen next, they say, but there isn't anybody to run against him, that
mm-hmm.
the opposition party hasn't been able to develop a candidate that, you know, would have any standing against him. And also while we were there, he'd gone into the rural neighborhoods, and he's just beloved there.
I see. Remains.
In the same way as, you know, a Palin is.
Right.
You know, it's that same...
Yeah.
The mirror images are kind of fascinating.
Sure, sure. I'm going to have to let you go, Jody. If you could distill your many conversations to a message for our listeners, what would that be? Let's make that the last question.
that, you know, that if we're really going to achieve peace, we need to know each other. And we have a new campaign. It's called Let's Talk. And that means, you know, let's talk to the people in our own community and get to know who they are. And let's learn about who we perceive as our enemies. And let's get smarter.
Okay. So I'm going to let you go. The website to learn more about, and Jody blogs about her trip to Iran at the website, is Code Pink, the number 4, and the word peace. One word, Code Pink. forpeace.org. Thank you, Jody Evans, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.